Documentary filmmaker Charlie Minn has spent his career largely focusing on true crime, with a particular interest in the stories of the borderland, including cartel violence, Chapo Guzman, and cross-border issues. His latest film, Bullets at the Border, examines the complex issues tied to three controversial cases involving Mexican citizens and U.S. border agents. Many of these cases are currently working their way through the U.S. court system. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak for this week's episode of On Film. Joining me in studio is Charlie Minn. His new film, Bullets at the Border, is expected to open in El Paso on December 1st. Charlie, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tell us about your new film. It's very timely. I think the cases surrounding it are very controversial.
This has been going on for way too long. I'm trying to shine a light and spread awareness, inform, educate about Mexican nationals being killed at the border. At the end of the day, nobody wins. We have a loss of life at the border. We have border agents taking a reputation hit. No one's going out celebrating these deaths. A lot of these are avoidable, if not all of them. And unfortunately, there's a rising tension, especially with our president now. There's just a escalating tension between Mexican nationals and U.S. border agents. These guys are not best friends. They're not going to go out and have a drink at the corner bar anytime soon. And unfortunately, it gets out of control and there's a loss of life at the border.
And there's three cases in the film, one of which focuses in our next door neighbor in Juarez. Do you want to talk about that briefly before we dive into the other two?
15-year-old Mexican national Sergio Adrian Hernandez Guadeca, in a really high-profile case in 2010, was shot and killed by U.S. border agent Jesus Mesa Jr. Mesa Jr. claims that Guadeca was throwing rocks at him. So one side saying he's a rock thrower at the time, the other side saying he's not. Someone's lying here. And the gun was fired from the U.S. The body falls in Mexico. It becomes a constitutional nightmare. Where did the murder take place? We have two governments, two countries, two laws. So it's a political crime, is it not? And political crimes often tell me that judgments are not based on evidence, but they're based on pressure. And when that happens, someone's usually going to get screwed. And chances are it's going to be a family. In this case, it's the Guadeca family, a poor family from Mexico. No rights in this case. And you could even say in Mexico, they have no rights either. And the way it stands right now is that the Supreme Court told the lower court, you guys will have to decide whether or not the Guadeca family can sue the U.S. government and Agent Mesa. So that's all they have to go on 7 years later.
Yeah. It's interesting that you know, as you research these cases, they're bouncing back and forth between the courts. And in the case of the Nogales shooting, that one, the court date keeps getting pushed back.
Yeah, that happened in 2012. We had Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, a 16-year-old, shot 8 times in the back by U.S. border agent Lonnie Swartz. Same situation like Juarez. The bullet was fired from the U.S., in this case, Nogales, Arizona. It travels a mere 50 to 60 feet, maybe a little more, hits Jose on the Nogales, Sonora side. Where did the murder take place? But in this case, I think the U.S. government could not overcome the fact that the kid was shot 8 times in the back. You shoot someone in the back, you're a coward.
Well, the interesting, I saw a preview of the film, and you know, when you watch your films sort of straddle the line between straightforward documentary filmmaking and investigative journalism, and oftentimes you're quite blunt, and I appreciate that. When you're approaching tragedies like this, how do you handle the situation? How do you approach it?
It's case by case. It's so delicate. It's so emotional. There's a lot riding on it. I think I've developed, through 25 films, you know, you look back at some of the films you've made, and I think it's like anything you do in life. You know, you try to get better. You go back, you look at your past work, and you say, man, I can't believe I did that at the time. You learn, you grow.
Yeah.
And I think now, as I call it accidental maturity, as you grow older, you learn to hear both sides more. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one thing that I regret earlier in my career, that I probably should have heard everyone sides more and then make the audience decide. I'm too emotional. I mean, I've always said whenever we're talking about human life here, and my films represent innocent people who have been murdered, you can't be politically correct, in my opinion, when you're talking about human lives. Mm-hmm. And I've stuck my neck out. I've taken a lot of criticism, and that's fine. I mean, we all have different perspectives in this world. That's what makes the world go around.
Yeah.
So I think in this film, I've tried my best to hear both sides, and we let the audience decide.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I've noticed is that, you know, and you've seen it, you've noticed it as well, is that the political rhetoric towards these cross-border issues is reaching a point where it's becoming incredibly toxic. How do you see this film contributing to the dialogue in a positive way?
I just think we have to hear both sides, consider what the Border Patrol goes through. I mean, they have a dangerous job. I'm not saying it's an easy job. And these Mexican nationals, they have to be looked at more carefully as well. I mean, just because someone has a rock in their hand doesn't mean you could fire into another country. There's the laws are complicated. There's a lot of gray areas. And I said it earlier, at the end, nobody wins whenever there's a loss of life at the border. No one's celebrating. No one's throwing a parade or a party here. The U.S. Border Patrol, they want safety. They don't want to fire at these kids. But according to them, in some cases, they have no choice. That's why I pose the question in the movie quite often, is it murder or is it self-defense? It's one or the other.
Yeah.
It can't be both.
Yeah. And in your interviews, you know, with activists, do you find that they're being that they're contributing to these dialogues in positive ways or not so much?
Well, I think we activists, and I consider myself a bit of an activist too. I think we have to be careful on what exactly we say. The power of words could be just that very powerful. We really want to be objective and fair and hear both sides and come from an angle. I see where you're coming from. We'll have to agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the fault that I had earlier in my career, is that perhaps I just came out and said it. At the end, though, it's my right. It's my documentary. It's my film. So I could do whatever I want. But as you mature into your field and into your profession, you learn to see the other side of the fence more. No pun intended in this case. You learn to see the other side of the equation. Mm-hmm. And Oliver Stone was my hero. I mean, he was the filmmaker that made me become a movie director, merely because of some of his past work, not so much his recent work. But, and he said in his interviews that I've seen, he's a three-time Oscar winner, how as he grew into his profession, he would see the other side of the fence, the other side of the equation. And that's kind of what I'm seeing now. Give everyone an opportunity to have their say. Let the audience decide. Some of my limitations came from being an independent filmmaker. I don't have the resources to track everyone down, travel, interview them, and do it the way you want to do it. Independent filmmakers always have limitations. So I don't want to use that as an excuse, but that's part of the reason why maybe I wasn't able to hear every side that I wanted to.
You mentioned travel a lot, and you know what I like about you as a filmmaker is that you straddle your time between New York and the border. This brings up a question for me, just as someone who enjoys the filmmaking process, is your editor is based in New York. How do you collaborate with him? How does that work?
A lot of phone work, a lot of emails, a lot of texting, more emails than anything. He sends me clips. We have a strict outline that we adhere to. We don't really see each other that much. It's a lot of it's emails. A lot of it is Vimeo links. And I look at it, and then I pass on notes back to him. He makes the adjustments. He sends the new link. I send that with notes back to him. So it's a true collaboration. And, you know, he throws in his two cents, which I really respect. And he's edited 24 out of my 25 films.
Yeah.
So at this point, if we cannot finish each other's sentences, then we're in trouble.
Yeah. So actually, one thing that I've noticed is, you know, when people edit films and when they're kind of sitting there, they tend to get very passionate about it. Do you find that this distance helps create a clean space in the collaborative process to sort of just present the ideas and not get emotionally attached to any one particular set of clips?
I do. If anyone saw how I edited my first film, A Nightmare in Las Cruces, I was literally over the editor's shoulder, and that gets unhealthy. You want to give your editor creative room, and ever since the first or second film now, I stay away. He's in his own room, no one's around, and he has clear space. So he only deals with me when he's ready to send the link. I don't know how other director editors do it. I really don't. It's not my business, but I think a director has to learn what works for you.
Yeah.
There's no rule book. It's what works for you. As unorthodox as it may seem, it's what works for you.
Yeah. Before I forget, I'd be remiss if I forgot to mention the final segment of the film, which involves a meth case, correct?
Yeah, we had a Tijuana teenager that, in my opinion, was baited into drinking liquid meth. And we actually shot a reenactment for that. I've been shooting more reenactments as my budgets increase. Many thanks to Amazon Prime. My numbers on Amazon Prime... I've been stunned. They've been off the charts. Word's getting out there, which is good for my career, and it's good for me to finance my future films like Orlando Pulse, the gay nightclub that was shot up. Las Vegas, I just began that. We did 14 interviews last week.
Oh, wow.
Interviewed an El Pasoan who was working at the concert that night as a security guard. So my budgets have increased. I'm able to finance films and get my work out there. So I'm on 25 films now in 7 years. I don't suggest anyone try that. It's unhealthy, honestly. Sometimes I'll just literally get sick, physically sick, because I exhaust myself. And I put my life on the attack mode ever since my dad passed away. My mindset just absolutely rose where I'm going to be pumping out films so that he could feel them from heaven.
So your output has just been astronomical. It's between one or two films a year. I think one
more, like three 25
sometimes.
In 7 years.
Gosh, take a vacation, please.
I need one, but I know every time I go to if you want to call it a vacation, within 2 hours, I'm on the phone, or there's an email, or there's a text that's connected to a film. So it's hard.
So you mentioned the Vegas shooting and the Orlando shootings. You know, we were talking earlier, and it's just become incredibly depressing that mass shootings in America are part of our daily life.
It's embedded into our culture, like it or not, agree with it or not. It's let's face it. I mean, my opinion is that this world has never been in a more unpredictable state. Look at El Paso in the past month. We had we have an unsolved murder. We never hear that in El Paso, but we have an unsolved murder, East Letta High School student murdered. I can't get that out of my head. I just cannot, for some reason. I just can't. Then we had a double homicide in Far East El Paso just last week, I believe. We had a Pebble Hill student commit suicide because he was bullied. There's violence is in the air, and we all have to be vigilant, aware, and smart about our actions.
Yeah.
And even then, there's no guarantee.
True. Having said that, though, I mean, El Paso is still one of the safest cities.
Very safe. We've had 16 murders this year, with about a month and a half left as we tape this. So we're on pace, probably what we've had in the last few years.
So your film is wrapping up post-production, and it's scheduled to open in El Paso on December 1st?
Yeah, it's going to run for at least a week at Bassett. All my films play at Bassett. People could watch the trailer at www.bulletsattheborder.com. And as always, I ask for the support of El Paso. It's a city I adopted. I absolutely love El Paso. It's a huge part of my life. The city humbled me and really altered my mind. This city did something to me. I'm so motivated when I'm here. I don't know what it is. The star on the mountain, the Bible is the truth, read it. I mean, that's, to me, what this region is all about.
My guest today is Charlie Min, a documentary filmmaker whose latest film, Bullets at the Border, examines three cross-border cases involving Mexican citizens and border agents. The film is scheduled to open in El Paso on December 1st at Premier Cinema. Charlie, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
On Film's producer is Lauren Terrazas. An archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak. Thank you for joining me.